Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments and structures, such as the Great Pyramid of Giza or the fabulous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, were lauded and listed as wonders of the world. And like Seas, Days of the Week, S Club and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. Other Magnificent Sevens celebrate more modern wonders, such as the Taj Mahal, or natural phenomena such as the Grand Canyon or the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is the Reverend Richard Coles. Now, these days, many of us choose or have to change from one occupation to another as industries close or necessity requires. Even so, Richard's professional life story is quite unusual, possibly unique. In the last few years, TV viewers have seen Richard competing on Strictly Come Dancing, as well as making occasional appearances on a whole variety of comedy panel shows. More regularly, he presents Saturday Live every Saturday morning on Radio 4. And that comes on top of being a clergyman. For several years now, the vicar of an Anglican parish church in Northamptonshire. And that comes after being a pop star. 30-something years ago, the Communards, Richard with Jimmy Somerville and others, were touring the world and topped the charts with their version of Don't Leave Me This Way in 1986. And that's before we get onto the works of fiction and non-fiction he has published in recent years. So Richard, rock musician turned reverend, turned radio star, turned writer, turned on the television. I was expecting an eclectic mixture of wonders from you, and your list doesn't disappoint in that regard, though here and there it does puzzle. Can I start with just asking the question, are there three or four Richard Coles, different personalities inside your skin, or does moving between these various activities just seem normal to you?
Well, you'd think so. And I've often thought if my CV landed on my desk, I would dismiss it as the work of a fantasist. But it just sort of happened that way, Clive, I think. And I suppose I do like a swerve once in a while. So I think there is just one. The continuities are perhaps harder to see than the discontinuities, but that's not really for me to judge, I guess.
We'll possibly come back to music in due course, but let's just establish for, I don't know, the age of people that might be listening to this podcast, but obviously if you were alive in the 1980s, the Communards were a very big band. I think you were the biggest selling record of the year in 1986. So that in itself is... possibly a surprise for anybody to find themselves in a big band like that.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, it wasn't a golden year because I think we only just pipped, I think it was Nick Berry, Every Loser Wins, to that coveted spot of the biggest selling single of the year. So it was in sort of perhaps a little hammock moment between the glories of punk and what was to come at the end of the 80s. But nonetheless, it's true. I mean, I can't... My nephew, Oliver... He's now 19, and a couple of years ago he became aware of the backstory in the lives of the adults around him, and he asked me if I'd been in a band with a look of surprise. Yeah. And I said, yes, I had, and he couldn't really believe it. And he said, are you on YouTube? And I said, I don't know. So he had a look, and at the end of it, he saw a video we'd made, and he said, it's funny, but even then you can tell there was a vicar struggling to get out. So, you know, I fell into it.
Yes, yes. And of course, you are available because you played with a band called Bronski Beat for a little bit, and then yeah. You went with Jimmy Somerville he was the sort of the most notable performer in the Communards. And you were playing, but you played, was it clarinet with Bronski Beat? And then you're on keyboards with the Communards.
Well, it was soprano saxophone, actually, with Bronski Beat. And then and then keyboards. I'm really a sort of keyboards is my thing. But I could have played the xylophone or I don't know, the stylophone even, Clive, and I hitched my mediocre talents to Jimmy's exceptional talent, and I would have been a pop star anyway because he was just so very good at it.
Nonetheless, there you were, and I mean, you're slightly underplaying your success, but you were touring. Well, you've toured America, you're in Europe. And of course, your nephew or whoever can see your performances on sort of Top of the Pops, that sort of thing in this country.
What a mixed blessing that is, like looking at photographs of yourself when you were a teenager, except they're there for all to see.
Yeah. But then you, did you discover a religious faith, or was it always there? Because you don't think of many pop stars being particularly religious. That's maybe a bit unfair on some of them, but... There it is.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think, as Charles Sisson observed, the vain, the ambitious, and the highly sexed are the natural prey of the incarnate Christ. So maybe it's not so surprising. But I was a chorister when I was a kid, Clyde, so I grew up with that stuff, although I thought it was nonsense. I mean, I love the music, and I like being in chapel. And I like the sort of... It was the era of kind of rather strange and ironic clergymen. And I enjoyed that. And I hope I've become a strange and ironic clergyman myself. So it was a return to territory that I knew, but actually embracing the content for the first time. So that was a bit, what came as a surprise to me, let alone anybody else.
I think certainly if the clue in the quiz was strange and ironic clergyman, I think people might guess you as your name.
There are plenty of us, but I suppose I'm the most noticeable one.
All right. Well, you do... You are always billed as the Reverend Richard Coles.
Yes.
Do you think it's important to make that point as a, I don't know if it's a status thing, but is it just to make the point that, you know, vicars can be fun too?
Oh gosh, what an awful thought. No, it's really just because I can't quite believe it myself. And I imagine my own bishop raising an eyebrow in surprise whenever I'm heralded in that fashion. But I think it's just because I quite like the idea of having vicars in the sort of mainstream conversation that everybody else is having. It's a place we used to occupy ex officio, but less and less now. So I sort of like it. And everybody else sort of calls themselves professor this or doctor that. So I thought if I had a title, and extraordinarily the nation has not seen fit to bestow a dukedom upon me quite yet, I might as well just use that one. If you've got it, flaunt it, Clive.
It's a matter of time. Maybe not a dukedom, but I'm sure there are other titles to come. Look, I've held off starting with your wonders, which is bad of me. So just sort of just sketch in the background, because we may come back to those themes. But your first wonder doesn't seem to explore any of these life themes at all. But nonetheless, it's your first wonder. Tell us what it is and why.
Oh, well, I disagree with your statement there. It's the Brompton bicycle, which seems to me to be one of the most vicarish things you could possibly have.
Well, I don't know. I thought the Brompton oratory might have been a more obvious thing for a man of the cloth, but the Brompton bicycle.
That'll teach me to spar with one of the finest legal minds of our times. I think the Brompton bicycle is, Clive, you know, it's a folding bicycle that looks like it's made out of Meccano in someone's shed. Basically, it is made out of Meccano in someone's shed, that folds into a sort of strange-looking tangle of metal. And then if you're good at this, you have a sort of Zen mastery of the unfold and the fold of the Brompton, you can sort of get it to all of a sudden click, and it becomes a bicycle that will speed you around. I think it's really designed for urban environs, best of all. In London, I like to use one all the time. I did actually use one in Uganda, where it wasn't quite so successful. The Seven Hills of Kampala were not really scalable on a Brompton, I found, but anyway, it was a useful lesson. But I think there is something... It's not just that I like the idea of beautifully engineered Professor Brainstorm-looking things. It's also just a lovely way to travel. It's such a beautifully made thing. And to sort of zoom around London on a folding bicycle, for me, it's a sort of experience of freedom that I rarely experience in the button-down life of a cleric.
Yes. Well, I suppose the first thing people might think, oh, yeah, that fits in with you turning up in Broadcasting House once or twice a week, because we've all seen, well, many of us will have seen W1A, where Hugh Bonville's party and Fletcher and others were always arriving at the doors of Broadcasting House and having difficulty with their folding bicycle.
Well, I mean, brilliantly observed by the ever-brilliant John Morton. Because it's true, I don't think I've ever arrived at Broadcasting House without unfolding my Brompton next to Alan Yentop unfolding his. There's almost a competitive element to it now, however, who can fold up his Brompton quicker.
Yes.
It's Alan.
Oh, okay. but the engineering aspect of the bike, you feel that satisfaction when you've got a bit of kit that works really well. And so it's that brand, which is a which is a groundbreaking brand, British brand.
Yeah.
It's not the cheapest folding bike, but it's arguably the best engineered.
I don't think there's anything arguable about it. I think it is the best folding bike. And believe me, I've tried a few. But also, and this is perhaps counterintuitive for somebody like me who cannot wire a plug, but I am fascinated by engineering. And my great-great-grandfather was an inventor, famous in his day. And I just think that maybe there's just maybe a tiny shred of gene that's come to me from him that makes me fascinated with engineering. He was very eccentric. He believed so much in the power of the machine to change people's lives that he thought we should treat ourselves as machines. And for breakfast every day, he had a Vaseline sandwich because he felt it lubricated his innards. This is true, that it lubricated his innards. I haven't tried it, but I imagine it would.
I'm sorry, a Vaseline sandwich doesn't sound quite like that. But
sounds like something you get in New York in 1982, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Vaseline. So anyway, the Brompton bicycle is a wonder for its engineering skill. It's an engineering excellence. But let's not dwell too far on that because that sounds too much like product placement, I suppose. Perhaps you'll get a free Brompton bike out of it. What's your second wonder, or who is your second wonder, rather?
My second wonder is Russell Harty.
Okay, I'm leaving a pause there because, intriguing. I know who Russell Harty is. He was on television a few years ago. He was a presenter generally, but I suppose best known for being a sort of chat show host. But if you list the most famous chat show hosts in this country, you might start with Michael Parkinson. You're going to include Terry Wogan, perhaps Graham Norton. Where does Russell Harty fit on this? Or is he on this your list for other reasons?
For all sorts of reasons. I mean, he was a terrific chat show host. And he had his sort of, well, it was more than 15 minutes of fame. He did rather a long stretch into the 1980s with his own show. And I think London Weekend Television, as we called it then. But he was a much more interesting person than, well, you know, you too have been a chat show host and you are a very interesting person too, Clive. So you would understand that he was a fascinating person. He came from a very, his father had a market stall in Blackburn and he grew up there. Scholarship boy in that generation of scholarship boys. And we ended up at Oxford with Alan Bennett and Ned Sherrin and that generation.
Yes.
And then he became... he was a schoolmaster at Giggleswick School in Yorkshire. And then he kind of drifted into the BBC, as so many of us have, and found his niche making arts programmes originally. But in a way, the career was not the most interesting thing about him. It was his life, which was extraordinary. It was like he had the sort of comic and social genius of the northwest of England, of Lancashire, wrapped up with a highly sophisticated person who was very happy to sort of troll the galleries of Tuscany and New York and be entirely at home there too. But he never lost the Blackburn market view of the world, I think, and he did it with such extraordinary aplomb. And then he died, unfortunately, of hepatitis when he was in his 50s, which was a terrible, it was a tragedy. But I've always been rather fascinated by him. And then I did his radio biography and went in search of him in places like Blackburn and Giggleswick and London and spoke to people who knew him and realised that he was just an endlessly fascinating person who I think his genius went into his life rather than his work.
Yes. Well, I mean, I would tend to agree that there's something about a Lancashire accent that is sort of funny. That Alan Bennett, in a slightly different way, has that sort of northern edge to his voice. But they, all of Coronation Street, all those accents there tend to be, charming and also quite funny. And him sort of contemplating or ruminating on something tended to be quite amusing. But as you say, he was perhaps... He did his arts programs, but he was best known to most viewers as a chat show host.
And just being beaten by Grace Jones live on the television, which is, I think, the clip that people would have. It's like you in the Bee Gees moment, Clive.
This is the awful thing about chat show hosting. You're only remembered by the thing that go wrong. And, Grace Jones is an extraordinary figure, and I would have thought it wasn't that comfortable to be beaten by her.
No, she's a strapping lass, that's for sure. But Russell could take a punch or two. And also, I mean, it's funny, I never met him, but having done this this documentary about him, I feel I knew him. And that when people who did know him speak of him, it's so vivid that I place myself in the scenario. It's a lovely story. Madge Hindle of Coronation Street was a neighbour of Russell's in Yorkshire and a friend. And in Giggleswick, the parish council asked him if he would ask her to open the village fete, and he said yes, he would. So we asked her, and she said yes, and he brought her along. And the chairman of the parish council greeted her and then announced the people, and we're very delighted, thanks to Mr. Arty, that the fete today will be opened by Miss Myra Hindley. And his life was littered with kind of mini disasters like that. He was also, you know, there was complication and also elements in his life which I think were difficult and challenging. And he just had this supreme... It's like the sort of Lancastrian version of chutzpah, if there's such a thing, that kind of saw him through some awkward moments.
Yes, you didn't know him.
No,
he had an interesting career. And yet he's number two on your list of wonders. I'm still not quite sure I grasp why he is there on your list.
I mean, there are heroes and there are heroes. And I always find the most interesting, and if this is something I've learned as a vicar, the most interesting people are not the people who look like the most interesting people. So Russell Harty was a sort of pond skater on the meniscus of popular culture of the 1980s, if I could put it that way. Well, that's how he would appear to people. But actually, he was a fascinating person. And his life connected with so many others. So just there's a lovely story about him. Ned Sherrin told me this. Ned was invited... Our summoned to Russell's deathbed. Russell died in Jimmy's, I think, in Leeds. It was a hospital in Leeds, anyway. And he was rather being beset by the tabloid press, who were determined to say that he was dying as a result of HIV, which he wasn't, actually. But his sexuality had recently become a matter of public report. It was the 80s. Mm. And anyway, there was a sort of ring of steel around the hospital, but Ned struggled up from London to get there and got through it. And there was Russell on oxygen on a bed, the bed he soon died on. And Ned leaned in and said, "Russell, what is it? What is it? What did you want me to say?" And he moved his mask to one side and he said, "Princess Margaret asked how I was twice."
That's a good story. That's a good last words, or very, very close to last words.
The other thing, Clive, I like about him is that I think, again, it's to do with being a vicar, where my life intersects with others' lives in all sorts of dramas, and life can be sort of solemn sometimes. But he had a wonderful lightness of touch, and I do like a lightness of touch.
It's not really a program, this podcast isn't for me to tell stories, but I didn't exactly meet him, but I was when he had his chat show moved to the BBC for a while. He was doing them live, and a guest he had on was Frankie Howard, who I was writing jokes for at the time. And we had to set up Frankie was going to tell a story on live television and fit it to time, which was for some reason I wasn't in the studio. I watched it at home. So I was on tenterhooks worrying about Frankie getting all the words out, because his genius lay in usually not saying the right words. We had to get it to time. And it was one of those things that was a story. And then somebody else had to say, "And what happened then?" or "And what happened next?" And I'm afraid Russell was sweating like anything to get the thing to time, and he failed to deliver the line, you know, to set up Frankie's last line. And Frankie had to do it himself, and he delivered the line correctly and on time. So, I mean, I'm not going to speak ill of Russell, but that was my moment of watching the two of them, and it, oddly enough, Frankie got it right and Russell got it wrong.
Yes, that's unusual. But I think that's interesting, because that is chat show host to chat show host. It's like you and I who do live radio programmes. We always listen carefully for the amount of time between coming out and the beginning of the pips, don't we? The crashing of the pips is the metric we use to judge each other, or one of them.
Yes. Well, all right. Well, now we're talking about your broadcasting career, or touching on it. So, I mean, I've obviously, people are going to say, it's odd for a vicar to be a pop star, or a vicar to be appearing on television. But your radio career, you know, presenting Saturday Live and indeed doing other programmes, I mean, why did you want to do that, and how did that come about?
Well, It's interesting. So I've been doing Saturday Live for more than 10 years now, and that's since I've been ordained. And so, but actually, my radio career goes back long before that. I was on Radio 3 for 10 years before I went off to theological college, but nobody listened to the programme. I mean, barely anyone listened to it at all, Clive. So I had sort of 10 years of live radio being noticed by about a dozen people, I really enjoyed doing it. So I've been doing it for a long time. And then, as so often happens, I mean, I left the BBC to go to theological college, and then I was ordained. I was in West Yorkshire and then Lincolnshire, and then I got a job back in London and headed back to London, and I was walking past Broadcasting House one day, and I don't know, I think... Fee Glavers Brompton had got a puncture and she was late, and so they said, would you come in and sit in for her? It was Torquil MacLeod, who you'll know well, who's a producer we both work with. So I did, and then Fee Glover got rather a taste for motherhood, and with extraordinary fecundity produced a string of children, and consequently maternity leave came her way, and that was my good fortune, because I got back into doing live radio, which I love doing. I think it's one of those jobs, isn't it? You either get it or you don't. And I think some people are just made for it. And I think I was made for it. And I was just very fortunate that I drifted into a radio studio. I mean, pop music was my... When I crashed out of pop music, I mean, it's a typical moment in a pop star's life, because you're 30 and you're fit for nothing, really. I couldn't drive, so I couldn't do minicabbing. But it was Emma Freud asked me to be the agony aunt on her show on... what was then called GLR, the BBC's London radio station. I only did it because she gave me a taxi home and I could stop at Sainsbury's in Essex Road and pick up my shopping. And that's literally how I got into radio.
And if you look at that screen, we're going to hear how you were responsible for one of the greatest Giggleswick's ever known, from the now deputy headmaster, Warwick Brooks.
Hello, Russell. Do you remember you were taking a class for geography and you suggested to them, for no good reason, that coal was not the only thing that came out of the ground in Yorkshire. Treacle did as well. So he borrowed it.
Right, there's so many things that arise there. So I think you've cleared up why the Brompton bicycle is so important, because the puncture to Fee Glover with her Brompton was one route for you into radio. So that, I think we've solved that as to why that's such an important wonder for you. Just happened to be there, but 10 years of broadcasting beforehand. And you've mentioned theological college, but I want to perhaps come back to the religious conversion, if that's the right word, as we go on to some other wonders, because we're going back to music with the next of your wonders.
Yes, that's the piano accordion. Now, there's a famous cartoon, I think it was in the New Yorker or something like that, which shows people arriving at the gates of hell and the devil greets them by handing them a piano accordion as they go in. Mm. It's not an instrument that I think would be the sound of, you know, celestial music for many, but it is. I've always secretly loved it, Clive. And reedy instruments I like a lot. I'm an organist, so maybe that comes from that. But also, I like it because it's the poor person's orchestra. And you can, with the piano accordion, provide a rich spectrum of sound. You have melody on the right hand on the keyboard, and then you have a button system in the left hand, which will give you bass and chords. And there's something about that I've just always loved. And then a parishioner of mine died and left me his piano accordion. And this coincided with the beginning of lockdown. So I found a Latvian accordionist online, and he taught me. And I'm pretty expert at Latvian wedding music. And if ever that is anything that could, you know, oblige you, I'd only be too happy to provide it. But I'm broadening my repertoire a bit now. But lockdown was... One of the ways lockdown for me was survivable was that I gave myself something to master and something that was sort of within reach, because, you know, as a keyboard player, at least a third of the piano accordion was already kind of was there. And it worked. The key to happiness in such things is often setting yourself a task which is of the right duration and complexity for the available time and skill.
So avoiding setting yourself up to fail, you've set yourself up to succeed.
Yes, but of course, failing on the piano accordion sounds so much like succeeding on the piano accordion, few could tell.
Well, so your musical abilities emerged at a very young age, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And we've mentioned along the way playing the clarinet, playing the saxophone, playing keyboards, playing the piano accordion. Any other instruments that we should bear in mind that you could also play?
Well, I started as a fiddle player, actually, piano and fiddle. And then I gave that up because I just I mean, I was a, this won't surprise you to hear, Clive, but I was a chorister when I was a kid and a sort of nerdy, swotty child. I was musically, I suppose, quite gifted, although it sounds rather boastful to say so. And that was all tickety-boo, and I guess that would have, had it not been for homosexuality, which sent me to London and crossed my path to Jimmy Somerville, so that pop music happened, perhaps I would have gone down that path. But homosexuality, if discovered in Kettering in 1976, did recommend that you sought its fulfilment elsewhere, really. So right. Off I went, and life changed.
So you left... Do you like Kettering? I don't know. I've never kettered. We're talking about being a musician, but you knew you were gay at a young age.
And was
I mean, and was that okay within your family?
I didn't know, because in those days, of course, it was a sort of clandestine and frowned upon, and indeed, in many ways, illegal thing. So, and also in a boys' public school, a revelation of that kind might not enhance your prospects socially, particularly. So I kept it to myself. And then when I was 16, I thought it was daft to keep it to myself. So I told my mum, and I mean, my mother and father, perhaps it wasn't what they most wanted to hear, but they were unfailingly loving and supportive. And then I went to London because that seemed to be the place to go if you wanted
to. So they didn't throw you out of home. You decided I will go as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old and try my luck in London.
Oh, yes. No, I never suffered anything like that at all. As I get older, I'm more and more aware and more grateful that I had the benefits of the unquestionable and unquestioning love of my parents.
Yeah. But you went off to London knowing you had musical ability. Were you keen on pursuing a pop career or a music career?
Well, I got run over, which was a stroke of luck, as it turned out, because I got criminal injuries compensation as a result. And that enabled me to buy the saxophone that was actually the instrument that got me into. So I used to go busking, and then I started playing saxophone and keyboards in bands, because soprano saxophone, which was the version I played there, was sort of rather just coming into vogue. And so I was lucky with that. I was not very good at it, but I did kind of make a noise. And so that sort of got me into playing sessions for pop bands, really. I was writing theatre music at the time as well, doing a bit of rehearsal, piano in the West End. And then, so I was, and you know, if you're a chorister, Clive, you start very early. So at the age of 8, I was started to sing music to a professional standard. And of course, one thing that comes with that is that you're absolutely steeped in four-part harmony. And if you've got those skills, then they're enormously useful if you're trying to make a living as a musician. So I would do arrangements, string arrangements, horn arrangements, all that kind of stuff. And I was never very good at it, but I was reasonably competent, and that was enough.
Sounds like you're good enough. And was meeting Jimmy Somerville, was that an important part of your career development?
Changed my life. Yeah, an extraordinary... You know, I arrived in London, gay runaway from kind of middle-class, middle England, public school boy and all that. And Jimmy came from a very rough, working-class, sectarian background in tenemented Glasgow. So he couldn't have been more different, really. But we had this one thing in common which threw us together. I didn't understand a word he said for 6 months, which is actually not a bad basis for the beginnings of a friendship. Very gruff Glaswegian voice. But I learned from Jimmy. I threw my lot in with Jimmy, and what I learned, among many things, was that I had assumptions about life, and they were assumptions that came from, you know, the various of privileges and entitlements, to use rather kind of current, perhaps overworked words. You know, that I wake up in the morning and I still think that the rising arc of my life is going to take me somewhere interesting, Uppingham today. Whereas Jimmy woke up in the morning and thought, how am I going to eat, or who are these people? I mean, and it was just interesting seeing the world through his eyes. And also, extraordinarily gifted person, burning, sizzling with natural gift. And also someone who, well, it was a roller coaster with Jimmy. You never knew, if you got in next to him, where you were going to end up. Fearless and bold in ways that I'm not.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You sound bold enough at that young age to set off in London, go into the music business, which can be good, can be bad, can be just hopeless.
Well, it was desperation, actually, Clive. I would never have done. I'm quite timid conventional sort of person by nature, I think. And had it not been for homosexuality, I don't know. I sometimes think I would have been a teacher in a prep school, and I've been discovered dead under a copy of the Daily Telegraph in the SCR, left there for maybe 3 years before anybody noticed.
I'm sure people would notice if you weren't alive. Quite apart from there'd be no stories being told in the SCR or any other common room. If we come to the 1980s being gay, of course, there's the tragic aspect of that being played out from then onwards with the HIV and AIDS epidemic.
Yeah,
that must have played an important part in the way you're. Yeah. Your life developed.
Funny, I've just been 30 years, 40 years after that, I'm revisiting it with a group of friends. We all went through that same experience together, those of us who survived. And we've all realised now that it was the defining event of our adult lives. Because, so at this moment of great vindication when, you know, Bronski beating the communards had happened and we were kind of pushing back at the boundaries of inclusion and we were vindicated commercially and also culturally, I suppose. And then this plague. It's funny, people talk about COVID as if it was the first plague since Spanish flu, but of course it wasn't. And HIV came along. And, well, I think between maybe about a third of the people I knew died in the 1980s and 90s. And most of them were young men in their 20s and 30s. And it was devastating. And sort of jumping around singing pop songs while that was happening on just seemed so dissonant in a way. And, well, I mean, it's a long story, but I think, you know, a sort of untimely immersion in mortality often sort of provokes people to religious thinking, exploration. It's certainly, it's interesting, two big spikes in vocations in the Church of England were 1946 and 1919, so after the churn of war. And I think for me too, I started to ask some sort of questions which I couldn't really find answers to in what was to hand. But I just remembered, I think like lots of people, Clive, I like churches, cathedrals. I sense that there's stuff there that you can't really fit anywhere else. And I just wanted to connect with that again. So I found my way back to church. And then when I did, to my immense surprise, I discovered that the content that I'd thought nonsensical stacked up, and then that changed everything.
Well, for some people, something like a pandemic or a war or any sort of tragedy or disaster makes one question whether there is a God, or if there is a God, why can he be so cruel?
Yeah.
But for other people, as you say, you're drawn to it. Can you explain why you are somebody who's drawn to religious faith, compelled by this the horrors, or rather than repelled?
Well, I mean, it's a very good question. But of course, at the heart of Christianity is a crucifixion. So if you look at the heart of Christianity, what you see there is limitless suffering. And then what lies beyond that, which is the hope of a life transformed, of a kind of dawn rising on the darkest of nights. And you stand with the disciples in a graveyard and discover not a body, but an empty tomb. And that's where that all begins. And also, I've never expected God would give me a pass from the horrors of life, and indeed he hasn't, but that's not the deal. You don't dodge any of that at all. It's what lies beyond it, a possibility beyond it. And that's not just true for me, but sometimes people come and see me, and some come to see me the other day whose life was sort of unimaginably hard and had suffered a kind of list of misfortunes, and each one would, you think, in itself be sufficient to displace any kind of hope at all. But funnily enough, it had confirmed him in hope.
Well, we've gone into deep waters there, which is all to the good, but we're at the moment, and just to round it off, talking about the piano accordion. So if I just go back to that, we've mentioned several different musical instruments, arguably all of them.
Appalling.
Well, no, many of them are other fine instruments that people you might have included on your list. The piano accordion, as you say, it allows for an elaborate sound, but has been supplanted, I suppose, in that regard by people having a small keyboard that they can play all the sounds of the orchestra and none.
Yeah.
So perhaps this is a more of a 19th, well, early 20th century musical instrument that, you know, time has possibly passed by, but not in your book, not in your no, over the world.
And also, I love the technical achievement of it. Again, it's an extraordinarily brilliant... I mean, it was really kind of... The version we know is it came from Italy in sort of 1850s, 1860s, or there are different versions of it around the world.
There are Italian versions, German versions, and...
Oh, yeah, and there are different ways of doing it. I mean, they can be very complex, actually. But again, it's this middle years of the 19th century when my great-great-grandfather was inventing... He invented the Christmas cracker-making machine, by the way, but that's an aside. You know, the same sort of thing was happening in accordion-making in Italy, and all of a sudden, these kind of people who came from very ordinary backgrounds were using their wit and their skill and opportunities to make some technically complex and wonderful thing.
So is there a Stradivarius of the... of the piano accordion that we should seek out?
Well, there's a Cremona, if you see what I mean. So there is a town in Italy. I can't remember the name of it, but it's where all the great accordion manufacturers live. And accordion nerds go there on pilgrimage, and you can tour the manufacturers, and they will bring out their wonderful beasts for you to enjoy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Have you ever wondered what happened to all those space-age promises that previous generations thought we'd have by now? You know, heading out for the day on your own personal flying cars or working on a space hotel somewhere in the far reaches of our solar system. Where are all those amazing inventions? Well, we're here to find out more on my new podcast, Where's My Jetpack? I'm Sarah Crudis, space expert, TV host and author. Join me and Luke Moore every week as we look into retrofuturistic tech that never was to decide whether it's still just science fiction or if some of these discoveries are actually a lot closer than you think.
I think we're very close to that happening on an even more regular basis. And what I think is interesting about that, too, is that's going to make the accessibility of getting to space available for more and more people.
So, if you've ever wondered whether we'll one day speak to aliens light years away, or you'll be flying to work on a jetpack, this is the podcast for you.
Think of the car parking spaces. They need to be massive, really wide.
No, the wings can fold up.
Well, they don't exist.
No, some of the cars which were designed had wings which folded up.
Are you happy getting in a plane knowing the wings fold up?
Yeah. Right. I trust engineering.
Trust the science.
Search Where's My Jetpack on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where's My Jetpack is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
All right, OK, so the piano accordion is on your list. And now the next one is the... tell us what your fourth wonder is.
Well, actually, we've rather nicely kind of set it up because it's the Grand Seiko Spring Drive. And this is a watch movement, the 9R, I think it is, which is made by Grand Seiko, which is the sort of posh end of the Seiko, vast Seiko watchmaking corporation in Japan. And, fine watchmaking has been considered a sort of monopoly of the Swiss for so long that Grand Seiko, when it came along, mounted a challenge. And now they make superlative watches. As you could possibly tell, Clive, I am a watch nerd. And again, I think this might be the genetic inheritance of my great-great-grandfather. But I have become... I think Grand Seiko is, I think they are peerless now, actually. And the Spring Drive is a movement which You know, there are very few innovations in watchmaking. You know, essentially, it's the same thing over and over again. But they really did do something new with the Spring Drive, which was absolutely brilliant. And I marvel at it. I do think it is a wonder of the world.
Well, it's obviously an expensive watch. It isn't the most. I mean, it's not a Rolex, but it's not a Timex. It's quite a valuable watch. And I know that from looking it up. When I first saw this on your list, all I see are the words you've put for your one, the Grand Seiko Spring Drive. I only really saw Spring Drive, and I thought, oh, it must be some street in Beverly Hills that you'd been to or something. So I'm afraid I was very ignorant about the... I like clocks and watches, but I haven't kept up to date. But this is... I mean, what is this, 50 years ago this was invented, something like that?
Well, the Spring Drive is what's brilliant about it is that it brings together two things which are normally not only apart but inimical. So mechanical watchmaking was almost destroyed by Seiko in the 1960s and 70s when they developed the quartz movement, which was a completely radically new way of not only powering a watch, but regulating its timekeeping. And it did so with a degree of accuracy that it was unachievable mechanical watchmaking. So that nearly wiped out, 200 years of fine watchmaking. But then mechanical watchmaking reasserted itself. And then Grand Seiko, they started really wonderful mechanical watches, and then they brought the two together. So the Spring Drive is essentially an automatic watch, i.e. it has a rotor that provides power through the movement of your wrist, so you don't have to wind it up. But it also has a quartz regulator on the escapement, which means that it has the accuracy of a quartz watch, but all the mechanical satisfaction of an automatic, and without having to change a battery too, because in a quartz watch, it's powered by battery, and so every 3 years or so, you have to send it off to be re-equipped. So it's wonderfully accurate. And if you like the Gubbins, and I do, the Gubbins are just so beautiful. And now, because of the internet, you can get wonderful animated sequences in which the Gubbins magically put themselves together to a rather dramatic kind of James Bond film score. And I just find my pulse races a little bit. There's something about the wonder of machinery and the engineering and the precision of these things that I love.
Well, this is certainly emerging as a theme, the engineering side of things that you're drawn to.
Well, it'll disappear quite soon, Clive, I promise.
Some of your wonders may not appeal to everybody, because if you're young, a lot of young people don't wear a watch unless they do it as a piece of flash jewellery, because everything tells us the time now. We have, you know, mobile phones that tell us the time. Our cooker tells us the time. And you don't really need. I like wearing a watch, but that's, you know, you and I are perhaps older than the old school. Yes, very much so. But is timekeeping very important to you? Many things on in your life. You've got to, I suppose you've got to start a church service at the advertised time. Certainly in broadcasting, you've got to get going. And if you've also got three other engagements to get to, a television engagement or something, that's you need to be on time for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Church of England time is a bit like Sandringham time. It is an elastic concept, really. But as you know, as a live broadcaster, you have to be to the second. And I think after years of doing that, we've been doing it for 30 years now, perhaps I am habituated to that. But I just really, really like beautifully engineered things too. And a watch. Perhaps also there's a bit of show in me that I would rather disavow normally, and I suppose a sort of discreet but beautiful watch on my wrist allows me a sort of hardly Beau Brummel, but do you know what I mean? That I like, and it's not embarrassing.
There's a certain amount of dressing up in clerical robes, of course.
Well, a huge amount of dressing up in my case, but that's for work, if you see what I mean. I mean, that's not about me, that's that's on with the motley. But I think I suppose I do fancy, perhaps fondly, that I would advertise my taste discrimination and thoughtfulness by having on my wrist not some kind of chunky great piece of gold with a whirling tourbillon or all the really kind of complicated bits and bobs that cost fortunes, but just something that is kind of sober and well chosen and beautifully made.
It's one for the connoisseur, and you hope that the muggers often go for expensive watches, might not recognise this as a £5,000 watch. They'll be looking for the £100,000 Rolex.
Easy to spot. But also, people don't mug Vickers, Clive, on the whole. I mean, no, it's funny, you do get a sort of pass from that. I don't know why, but there's something about the dog collar which does give you, I don't know, it changes. It could sometimes reverse the polarity of either hostility or the opposite, in fact, as you go. It's a funny thing.
All right, so it's well worth wearing a dog collar, not just for appearing on television or something, or in church. It's a protective shield.
Not protective exactly, but it does elicit responses that you otherwise wouldn't elicit. And that can be for good or ill, but often it's for good. And I think for me, who's nosy and also curious and interested in people, it elicits often conversations that come out of nowhere from people who perhaps wouldn't normally volunteer stuff about themselves. I think there's something deep in our cultural memory that is that you have a sort of role as confessor or something, or as a keeper of secrets, or as someone in whom you can share confidence. I don't know.
Well, now, looking at my rather cheaper watch than a Seiko, I will. We have to see if we ever move on.
Oh, God.
But we're talking about your role as a vicar, and that leads us neatly once to your next wonder. Yeah.
An undisputed wonder of the world is choral evensong. And this is one of the great gifts that the Church of England has given the Church Universal. And it's typically Church of England. It was cobbled together out of pre-existing sources in such a way as to dodge screaming sectarian fury coming from all sides. So it was kind of forged as the Reformation began to get underway in an attempt to reconcile the irreconcilable by committees. And essentially what it came up with was something, to the surprise of everybody, of enduring beauty. I grew up with it, and I think anyone who's a chorister in the Anglican tradition and grows up with choral evensong, choral matins too, is marked for it by life, because it is just such a beautiful thing. And I do it now. So, you know, Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, you will find me in church singing the praises and responses, the Magnificat, the Nunc Dimittis, speaking the collects, which somebody in exactly the same spot in my church has been doing since the middle years of the 16th century.
Yes. Now, do you have a big congregation? The place you're vicar in is not a large place, is it?
No, we're 4,500 people, so we're a small parish. And we'd see on a Sunday, we would probably get around 100 to 120, but not for choral evensong. Choral evensong is one for the aficionados now. So you would sometimes get a dozen people in the congregation and more in the choir. But actually, that doesn't really matter, because it's the service is offered to God, not for the entertainment of the people. Lovely to have the people there if they want to be there, but it's a sort of prose service in a way, as in professionals, I mean, because it comes from the monasteries. Originally, it was offered, these were the daily office of monks and nuns, so not for public consumption. But it was the Church of England, being the Church of England, kind of adapted it for public use. But you could quite happily sit there and sing it, without anyone in the congregation at all, because it's the important member of the congregation is God. And, God is a faithful attender.
Do you love being a vicar?
Yes, I do. I mean, not all of it. No. Parts of it are very different. We have a deanery chapter working breakfast, which I will not miss at all. But no, I do like being a vicar. I love it.
Now, you've mentioned you're gay, and I'm not sure I fully understand where the Church of England has got to as far as homosexuality is concerned. You wrote very movingly about your partner, your husband, who died a few years ago. Was everybody comfortable with the idea of a vicar being, in effect, married to another man?
Well, I mean, nobody knows. I don't think even God knows where the Church of England is on the issue of homosexuality. So it's very much a work in progress. But progress is perhaps not the right word, because often I think we were in reverse, really. So we're trying, as we always try to do, to reconcile irreconcilable opinion now. And that is mostly now to do with what we call issues in human sexuality. Too many sibilants in that to feel comfortable with. And I don't know where that's going. Meanwhile, people get on with their lives. So the Church of England, theologically, ecclesiologically, might be having rows about these things. But actually, in my church, and, we're in Middle England. It's a Daily Mail reading parish. But when David and I turned up, nobody batted an eyelid, actually. They were just happy to get to know us, and we just fitted into the community perfectly happily, because guess what, we weren't the only gays in the village. And that's, you know, more and more people's experience. And the Church of England at its best has been a church which has set the bar very low, really, and rightly so. So we're here for the benefit. You know, somebody once said the Church of England is the only organisation that exists for the benefit of its non-members. So we're here for everybody, and yes, everybody comes. And the people who come looking for what we offer are people whose lives are, you know, sometimes not consistent with what the Church of England thinks a life should look like. But I'd much rather deal with them than deal with the sort of Church of England having an attack of vapours about it.
The that's another service, the vapors, that choral vapors.
Choral vapors, that's wonderful.
Middle of the night, probably. But as you say, the Anglican Church, the Church of England, has a history of really being a compromise between Catholicism and the Reformation, between high church, low church, and accommodating. Yeah. So maybe on this issue, it's just exercising its normal practice of
And a failed.
It would be hard to say ducking the issue at times.
Well, I think sometimes there is wisdom in delaying a definitive statement and wait for the world to change. You see what I mean? And sometimes I think that if you can lodge something for a second in the long grasses, that maybe our argument will change, and by the time we go back to pick it out of the verge, we're worried about other things. I don't know. It's a tricky one, actually, Clive, and I do find it very burdensome having to shoulder that, really.
All right. Well, of course, I follow that. Perhaps I should have raised this when we were talking about watches and timekeeping. How do you have the time to be a vicar for some days of the week, certainly Sunday, and other days, parishioners to visit and so forth, and to be in London presenting a radio programme, and to do, either writing books or appearing on the television or whatever? How do you fit it all in? How have you found the time to write, well, sort of memoirs, autobiographies, but also a book about saints and a novel, I think?
Yeah, my first novel is arriving in June. By getting up early in the morning, actually, by not having children. So I don't have children. I have two needy dachshunds, but it's not quite the same thing. And I can neglect them without fearing that I'm going to be prosecuted for it, you see what I mean? So I get up early in the morning.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure about that. I think people who neglect their dogs can be up before the beak.
Yes.
Or certainly up before the RSPCA.
I wouldn't dream of neglecting my dogs. One is sleeping contentedly at my feet. You might hear snoring noises and things. But no, I get up early in the morning, Clive. So I aim to be at my desk at 5, and then I do 2 hours writing before I do anything else, and that's fine. But the trouble is, it only really works if you get to bed at a reasonable hour. And I quite often find that, because I'm busy, I'm quite often working in the nights as well. And one of the things I was finding was that I was just wearing myself out a bit, and I thought, well, this is a bit ridiculous. So I just want to. I suppose I'd like to sleep a bit at nights. So that would be good.
Yeah. You share a lot of yourself in your writing and in your general way of going about things. Do you ever sort of regret exposing yourself, if that's the right way to put it?
I think I look like I share a lot, but of course I share what I choose to share. So, and in a sense, when I do that, I'm sort of mindful of a tradition that goes back to St. Paul. I mean, I would hesitate to make two a closer comparison between him and me. But there is a confessional tradition within Christian literature, I think, which I sort of get, I think. I don't regret it, partly because I think also that I've quite happily shared with the world aspects of myself which do not speak to my virtue or credit, but there's nothing wrong with that. I did drop my brother in it rather badly once, which...
Yes, you did. Tell us about that. Had been a police officer.
Well, my brother was a police officer, and it's difficult for me to talk about, actually, because it's subject to an inquiry at the moment, Clive, but I can say that he was an undercover police officer, and allegations were made about him when he was serving as an undercover police officer, which are being examined at the moment. But I unintentionally sort of semi-revealed him as that by referring to his past in a book I wrote long after it had happened and when he had retired, and unintentionally, I suppose, pointed towards him in connection with that work, and that was to lead to, well, really the horrible consequences for him, in that he had to step down from his job. He was a deputy police and crime commissioner, and And also, he was the subject of intense media interest for a while, which was extremely intrusive for him and his wife. And, you know, regardless of the merits of the allegation, it was very difficult for him. And he is my brother. And and that was, I just wish I hadn't done it, but it was unintended. It just one of those things I hadn't been alert enough. And
as I said, we don't need to go into the merits of the allegation, but it's what's the consequence? Is it you're just writing, oh, I did this, I did that. Oh, my brother. It's hardly a walk-on part in the book you were writing. Perhaps a couple of sentences. But when you're talking about your own life and real people, there are things that can happen, unpredictable things. So you might think, oh, as you say, you wish you hadn't written that. It didn't need to be in the book at all. It just happened to be a line.
I just didn't realise that it was potentially damaging. And what I've always, when I have written stuff which I thought about, which involves other people, which I thought is awkward, I've always sent it to them and said, I'm very happy to either lose this entirely or change it if you wish. One person asked me to lose something entirely, which I did. I wrote a lot about Jimmy and the sort of extraordinary escapades that Jimmy got into with a frankness that was perhaps notable. And I wrote to him and said, listen, I'm happy to lose all of this. And he wrote a lovely email back and said, it's your story, tell your story, it's fine.
Yeah. But he's a pop star, and you know, a few stories about him may or may not be damaging, but may just add to the myth. But if you're writing about a crime commissioner, there are possible consequences.
Well, and so writing about David's death, again, you know, that wasn't just something that affected me, but it was deep. Of course, it affected his parents and his siblings. Mm. So before that was sent off for approval before that went into the public domain too. So I do try to take care. It's risky though, Clive, and I sometimes I've really enjoyed writing fiction because I felt I've not had to worry so much about that stuff.
Sure. David was your partner, and you wrote about his death, and also the what led to it, and what he was like. So, as you say, you are in danger of risking offending somebody or upsetting somebody. If you make it fictionalised, you could have invented two vicars living together, and that's fiction, and it may or may not have something to do with my own life.
And you know, there are, you know, people are entitled to privacy, and people are entitled to respect for those areas in their lives which are, you know, difficult and sensitive, which is why I would always ask permission. But there's more to it than that, actually, if I'm truthful, because, you know, I put my version of a story out there, and I'm fortunate that I have a readership that's going to engage with that. Well, I hope I do. And then lots of other people don't have that. So, I don't know, I do feel a bit uneasy about it, to be honest.
We're coming on to your sixth wonder, and I have no idea what you mean by this or what this can be about, your sixth wonder.
Old bags.
Old bags.
Yeah, one of the great, great gifts of the Church of England to our world is old bags. It's a great place to be, an old bag. And I love, love, love my ministry to old bags, so much so that I wish I could become an old bag very often.
So are we talking about old people, old women in particular?
Old women who are difficult and awkward and confrontational and cussed, And the Church of England has long been... I should say, when I say old bag, that's not intended in any pejorative way at all, but it's just, I think, what it would conjure in people's minds, the kind of person I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, you can see how it might be interpreted as a pejorative term. It's perhaps a term somebody might use about themselves, and we'd be entertained by. They might object to their vicar.
Well, they would, bags I'm thinking of would object to anything and everything, and and would also berate me for it fiercely at the church porch, as indeed they sometimes do. But I love the old bags, Clive, because they are power. They are the muscle that keeps things going along, and they tend to be kind of nosy and awkward, but they are the people who keep the show on the road. And one of the great things about being a vicar is you realise that so much, you know, the pulse and the heartbeat of communities, so much of that comes from old bags and old baggery, and I want to praise them.
All right, well, I'm trying to stick within the word the way you're using it, because if you say of somebody they're an old woman... that might be just an accurate description of somebody's age, but this is a more sort of military wing of more militant wing of being an old woman, is being an old bag who is standing up for her rights, right or wrong.
Yes, exactly. And also, you don't have to be an old woman to be an old bag, actually. I love seeing young women, indeed sometimes some young men, who I think, oh, you're going to be an old bag. And that's good to see, because they have the qualities. And also, I mean, I think old bag, it's a bit like, you know, it's one of those words that is pejorative that I think should be reclaimed for praise, because I've come to very much value and respect and admire and indeed love the old bags in my life. And I think old baggery should perhaps be, it's rather like the old contemptibles, isn't it? It should be turned into a badge of honour rather than a slur.
I'm not sure you're running with the way things go these days. Often people are more obsessed by the offence in a word rather than adopting it.
Oh, I know.
It varies, obviously. You must be wary of this in all aspects of your life, whether you're on preaching a sermon or introducing a live or talking to somebody on live radio.
Yes, and I think once, you'll know this too, Clive, that one sort of has to be very alert and self-police quite diligently, because there are really quite serious dangers that would follow if you got it wrong. I'm about to retire, so perhaps there's a certain latitude as I head to the exit that wouldn't be there before. But I mean, I think there's a serious point. It is not wise to unnecessarily give offence. I think it is sometimes useful to use language in such a way to surprise people and maybe derail them a little bit from a kind of unexamined way of thinking. I'm so fascinated talking to you, Clive, because you're a barrister, and because I've always really rather admired that and thought I would quite like to, if I were more combative, I'd like to be a barrister myself. But, you know, you're so good with the way you ask questions and the way you use words.
I don't know about that, but you can. You could certainly have been a barrister if things have taken you in a different direction.
Well, I'm not combative enough, and also I don't think I could quite cope with, I don't know, representing someone at an employment tribunal in Walsall. I'm not sure that. I mean, if I could be F.E. Smith, that would be different. I'd love that.
You'd be a perfect F.E. Smith. It's hard for anybody to be F.E. Smith nowadays. It's not quite as F.E. Smith was a huge star by being an important lawyer, barrister, which is it's harder to get that sort of level of fame and excitement from that sort of practice. But I'm sure you could have done it if anybody.
I wear a wig beautifully.
Yes, I'm sure you do. Look, I'm just worried that I've mentioned it right at the beginning, but we haven't just touched on it, because a lot of people, the way these things work, will know you more from your appearance on Strictly Come Dancing than everything else put together. What made you agree to do Strictly Come Dancing? Did you expect to win, or were you expecting to be the sort of John Sargent and Widdicombe candidate for a bit of a laugh?
Well, when my agent was discussing it with me, he said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you're not going to win." And I genuinely felt this little prickle of indignation that he thought, my own agent, that I might not win Strictly Come Dancing. And I think, truthfully, Clive, there was a delusional part of me that thought that there was perhaps a Justin Timberlake waiting, or a Twinkletoes, or a Mr. Bojangles waiting to be released, but there wasn't. And I'd only discovered that when 10 million people were watching me do a Paso. After my Paso Doble, which was my swan song, almost my overture, actually. I remember seeing my mother the next day and saying, she watched it and she said that I looked like a walrus that had been tasered. And and that tells you. But I mean, so bad. I mean, I loved it. I had a marvellous time.
Everybody seems to say that however awful their experience looks to be from the outside, or wonderful, everyone says, oh, I really enjoyed the training, the getting to know people, the working with my professional advisor and so forth.
Well, I mean,
as good as that?
It's a bit like Christianity. You have to say it's wonderful, don't you? Of course, the more interesting story of Strictly is the Tornia account, but that's not. I've obviously saved that for a novel, but but it is wonderful, and I think it's. I think why I loved it so much. It was like being a child and playing again, only with the most fantastic toys and playmates. So that was just wonderful, and also as somebody, I love, as you probably know, I like I like seeing how things work. And the complexity of Strictly is just, logistically, it is so complex and difficult. And seeing people who are the best at what they do, doing the best they've ever done, was one. I mean, the professional dance is astonishing. Dave Archer and the band, astonishing. But also just the guy who does, I say just, the guy who does the Steadicam. I mean, they're just brilliant. And to see it being made effortlessly, with the appearance of effortlessness, it's not.
Yeah.
Well, it was so thrilling and exciting.
So you were genuinely disappointed to be eliminated early on, and you were hoping to be there in the final.
Yeah, I mean, I was genuinely disappointed because I was having such a nice time. I was quietly outraged because I thought, how could the world not acknowledge the uniqueness of what I was doing? Well, it did acknowledge the uniqueness of what I was doing, but not in the way I expected. But also it was like being, I remember, so I got booted off, and then you're given what they call the death flowers, and it's a bunch of flowers saying thank you and goodbye. And you get into a cab and you're driven away. And I remembered being taken home from a children's party when I was a little boy. I think I'd been sick or something. Mm. And waving at my friends from the back of my mother's car as it departed. And they were carrying on, having a lovely time. And I was going home. And it just felt like that. It is, do you know what it is about Strictly Time? I think one of the reasons why it's so popular, it does connect to something of childhood. Actually, it's a bit like Christmas. Yeah. It takes us back to our own childhoods, and it stirs stuff in us that goes very deep and is very unmediated by you know, adult compromise or something.
And was it the dressing up you liked, or the obviously you're musical, so you could at least in theory should be able to cope with, you know, moving to a rhythm and understanding where you were in the piece.
You'd think. But I mean, I love dressing up, but even I found the dressing up a bit excessive. I was given a wig once, and the thing about, I remember once Ginger Rogers saying that she did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in heels. Mm. And if you look at what people do in Strictly, you know, it's as if gravity is optional somehow, or as if towering heels are somehow there to assist you as you move around a dance floor, and they're not, and they're just wonderful. And I formed a very deep and lasting friendship with Di, who was my dance partner, who is the Australian champion. And which is lovely. I mean, our lives were so different. And one of my favourite things was discovering how to, there's a bit where she said that she modelled herself on Ariel. And I said, oh gosh, yes, I love The Tempest. It's one of my favourite plays. And then I realised she meant Ariel the Little Mermaid. And so we had a sort of, that would happen quite often.
But who did you bother yourself on, Prospero or Caliban?
Sycorax, I think, would probably be the name. I just couldn't do it. I'm not as fat and old. And I did discover also that I have one leg significantly longer than the other and arthritis in both knees. Yeah, and I'm 1 degree off obese. That was the result of my medical with a rather laconic doctor in Harley Street when I was going forwards.
All right. Well, at least you passed the medical. They allowed you to take part. You weren't condemned from the word go.
If I had heard one leg significantly longer than the other, 1 degree off obese and arthritis in both knees, there might have been a message in that perhaps I should give it some more circumspect consideration.
So we come to your last wonder, if we may. And again, a puzzling one, just looking at it. What is this about?
Seafaring. Hmm. Well, it's a recent... It's one of the things... I always thought when you get... I put off Wagner until my mid-40s, because I thought I want something meaty to get into in the last half of my life, or the second half of my life, you see. And so I tend to think that perhaps after 50, I wouldn't really discover anything that would captivate me so much, but I did discover seafaring, and now I absolutely adore it. And I just can't think why I didn't discover it sooner. Not only do I like
What sea are you faring? What are you doing in your seafaring? Where you're going on a big boat? You've got yourself a dinghy?
Oh, God, no.
Sitting by the coast looking at it?
I'm talking about big boats with lavish accommodation and magnificent hospitality.
So cruising?
Well, cruising and linering and all that sort of thing. I adore cruises. One thing David and I discovered was cruises. And I remember doing the first one. I was a paid job and thinking, this is like being locked in Wellingborough Golf Club for 2 weeks.
Yes.
And it was like being locked in Wellingborough Golf Club for 2 weeks, but it was the most fun. And what you have to do is throw yourself into it. So that's all fun. But what I really love is being at sea. There is something... I remember I was on a ship, small ship, and it was, I think, the first time I realised how much I liked seafaring. And I was travelling from St Kilda to the western fjords of Iceland. And it was nearly midnight on a summer's night. And the sea was like glass and it was still light. We were going on about 15 knots at a depth of almost about 2 kilometres, I think. And I remember thinking, this is like being in space somehow. I didn't stand at the front like Kate Winslet in Titanic, but and I was alone on the promenade deck, and then I realised I wasn't alone. There was a woman there, an old bag, actually, and we got talking, and she just was very forthcoming about her life, and she'd had an extraordinary life. And I said, what do you want to do now? What's left? And she said, I'd like a noble death, which I thought was a very interesting thing to say. And I said, well, what did you have in mind? And she said, I'd quite like to go down on this ship. And I sort of get that. There would be something about going down on a ship that deeply appeals to me. Right. I mean, obviously it'd be nice if I don't want to drown anybody else as part of the realisation of this fantasy, but if I could go down on a ship, I'd quite like that as an end.
No, I'd have found that quite worrying, somebody standing next to you on a ship saying, I want to go down on a ship, because maybe she was going to do something to achieve that, and you would have been an innocent victim.
But she didn't look like the sort of person who would know how to open a bilge, Clive. So I felt confident that it was not going to happen. But there was something about... I think it's a bit like being in space somehow. I don't want to go to space at all. The idea of achieving zero gravity next to Elon Musk does nothing for me at all. But but this moment of just being on the prow of a ship, cleaving the North Atlantic, was so beautiful.
Sounds like you were lucky, because St Kilda to Iceland, that could be quite a rough passage many times.
Gosh.
A year.
I mean, but the funny thing is, you'd think, you know, obviously that would be the place, sort of the Cape of Good Hope or something. But actually, the worst I've ever had, and it was really bad, was the Bay of Biscay, which is a notoriously lumpy bit of water, as seafarers say. But I was once in it, in I think it was a Force 11, and it was really extraordinary. And awful at the time, so I was as sick as a dog, and so was everybody else, and everything was sort of clattering around. But then one of the things I like about seafaring is adventure, that you can survive. And we came out the other end of it, and there was something, it's a bit like seasickness. I used to be put off seafaring because I can't think of anything worse than seasickness, but actually it passes, and then you're on the other side of it, and then you think, oh, actually, this is all right.
Well, it passes and it doesn't pass. I mean, if you're seasick and you are sick, you're still seasick. It's not like throwing up and getting rid of some poison in your body. You're still going up and down on the water. And if your body doesn't like that, then you're stuck until you get to dry land or at least flat seas.
Well, I don't know. For me, I find it's kind of worn off. Perhaps I've got my sea legs a bit, but I don't really even notice the movement of it. I've just come back from one, actually. But I was on the biggest cruise ship in the world, which was like, if you imagine Canary Wharf on its side, taken over by Disneyland, it was that. And actually, I didn't even notice we'd left port, actually, because there's no movement at all. Extraordinary thing. Sort of awful, but I was fascinated by it. And again, great thing, if you're a vicar, you have a unique privilege, which is that you're allowed to go cruise side to tend to the spiritual needs of the crew. So I'm allowed to go through the door which separates the what they call the hotel side from the crew side, and then I can see how these amazing things work.
So when you say you were paid to be on one of the ships, to do something akin to your radio work or your TV work or vicaring?
No, I do a turn. It's an evening with the Reverend Richard Cole, so I and regale people with my fund of anecdotes and stuff, and actually, I really like it. And also, should spiritual. I just did 2 burials at sea on my last cruise, so just last week, actually, in the Gulf of Mexico, which was a new experience for me.
Well, you're a jolly handy person to have there, because you're, as you say, an evening's entertainment for the trip, but also you can help out with. Could you marry people as well as conduct funerals?
Well, the legalities of that are complicated. I don't know, actually, Clive, but the special license I would need would probably confound all the apparatchiks of Lambeth Palace to provide, so I don't know.
Well, I have a sort of more or less sensible question. It's all very well to get a bit seasick if you're a passenger and it's uncomfortable, but if you're booked to appear at 9 o'clock after a lovely fish supper, and you're going to an hour and a half or 2 hours of Reverend Richard Cole, and you're feeling sick or being sick.
I've had this happen, Clive. I was on, I can't remember what the name of the ship was, but we were in Choppy, again, it was the Bay of Biscay again, and I was giving a talk in the theatre, and I finished, and I knew I was going to be sick, and I went off stage, and I opened a door, and fortuitously, providentially, it was a loo, And as I opened the door, a spume of vomit hurtled from my mouth, but landed perfectly in the toilet bowl. And I'd like to think that the hand of God was in that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think he could well be.
I leave that charming image with you.
Well, oddly enough, I have a similar image. I was once on a train going to do a talk in Durham, and I was very, very ill with food poisoning.
Oh, no.
And the loos at either end of the carriage were locked and in use. And I did, so I don't say I prayed to God, but there was a certain thinking, oh, please, will somebody come out of one of these things? And if it was the hand of God, he opened one of the doors and allowed me to get into the loo just in time. And it was that may have drawn me into the church as well. Look, Richard, this is an unhappy note to be ending on with you and me vomiting in Toulouse. But seafaring, I suppose, that go. But Northamptonshire is a long way from the sea. So
Well, I'm retiring next year to the sea. Well, not to the sea, to very near the sea. So I will be able to have the sea very close to hand.
A coastal cottage or a house?
Yes, it's a little cottage in a village in East Sussex, actually not far from Beachy Head. So I have the chalk cliffs of Sussex to look forward to.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your wonders with me, your seven wonders. Now, I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it in this podcast. And I'm struggling somewhat to know, because you've argued, if that's the right word, in favour of all of them so magnificently. I think I should stick within the world of engineering, because that's clearly been an important and unexpected part of your life that's emerged. And because I doubt it's going to crop up that often with other guests, I think I might go with the piano accordion.
Oh, marvellous.
Seems sufficiently engineered and also quirky, but it reflects your musical side as well as everything else. So I'll make that, if I may, your wonder of wonders.
Well, that's the one I would have chosen, I think, Clive.
Oh, good.
Yeah, thank you.
How very polite of you. So thank you very much, Richard, the Reverend Richard Coles, for sharing your seven wonders.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform, site or provider you found us on. Thank you very much.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.